WBAI at 99.5 FM. We're broadcast and streamed at WBAI.org.
It ain't gonna happen until folks like you and me just stand up. Well, you've been sitting way too long.
Oh, step up.
You know what's right and you know what's wrong.
Rise up.
Don't let the system hold you down.
Stand up. Stand up. You've been sitting way too long. 99.5 FM, WBAI, New York.
Crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace. Yes. None is crying out for justice.
Still gotta get it, equal rights and justice, or there can be no peace. I'm Mimi Rosenberg, and this is an Equal Rights and Justice special for WBAI 99.5 FM, where every day is and must be Women's History Month Day. Embedded in the month of March, which is Women's History Month, this year's theme is Celebrating Women Who Tell Her Stories, which aims to honor and recognize the contributions of women who have made a significant impact for the furtherance of democracy towards equal rights and justice, and to build that beloved community dreamed of by the late Martin Luther King Jr. One of the most significant aspects of Women's History Month is it's education. We must use this time to teach about women throughout history who have fought for equality and justice, and are trailblazers who continue to make a difference. And as we celebrate Women's History Month this year, it is essential to remember that there is still so much work to be done toward achieving gender equality. So we seek to inspire future generations of girls and young women, our LGBTQIA siblings, to dream big and believe that they too can change the world. To help us do that, Dr. Clarence Lussain is a professor, former chairman of Howard University's Department of Political Science, and current director of the International Affairs Program. He's an author, activist, scholar, lecturer, and journalist. No underachiever there. For more than 40 years, he's written about and been active in national and international human rights, anti-racism politics, diaspora engagements, U.S. foreign policy, democracy building, and social justice issues such as education, criminal justice, and voting rights. His most recent book, For Our Purposes, is $20 and Change. Harriet Tubman and the Ongoing Struggle for Racial Justice and Democracy. Ah, Harriet Tubman. Negro slave, about 5 feet tall, scars. Scars on her neck and her deep scar on her forehead. Plain woman, looks harmless, but carries a gun. Wanted for helping slaves escape on the Underground Railroad. Reward, $40,000. Wanted, dead or alive, Harriet Moses Tubman. Quote, I freed 1,000 slaves. I could have freed 1,000 more if only they knew they were slaves. And now with the wonderful Dr. Clarence Lussaine, Harriet Tubman's vision of democracy, and we are so pleased to have you with us.
Thank you.
So that was the description that I read from what might have been or not. That is the description of Harriet Tubman, an actual wanted poster, but she was wanted. But the thing that is most interesting to me about your book, $20 and Change, and we'll get to what that means if people haven't figured it out already, the $20 bill hint, Harriet Tubman and the ongoing fight for racial justice and democracy. Your book has such, I really revere it in so many ways because it doesn't leave her as just this almost bigger than life fictional type character who did the impossible, although she did. It places her in the context of women and women's struggles from time immemorial and through the unrealized democratic vision that Harriet was in fact struggling for today. So I wonder if you can take us up to that fabulous context that you help us understand the marvelous Harriet Moses Tubman.
So again, thank you for having me. And most people, you know, I was an admirer, still am, of Harriet Tubman. Just the story that we knew about her that we learned in elementary school, that she escaped herself out of slavery in 1849, and then she went back numerous times to rescue family members and others. And again, this was by foot through, you know, challenging terrain, and with, as you pointed out, her being a fugitive. And at any point, if she would have been captured, if not killed, she certainly was going to be put back in slavery and treated harshly. So we knew that story. But when it was announced in 2016 by then Treasury Secretary Jack Lew that there would be changes on U.S. images on U.S. paper currency, and that Harriet Tubman would be put on the front of the $20 bill and replace Andrew Jackson, who at the time they were going to put on the back of the bill. That's still a controversial issue for sure. So I wanted to get some more context, and it immediately struck me that what we were looking at was two very different visions of the country. One of Harriet Tubman's, which, as you pointed out, was inclusive. That included a multi-gender, multi-racial, multi-class perspective on where the country should go, versus Andrew Jackson, who was white supremacist in all the billions of ways you can think about it. And so that's when I began to do some digging. And as I unfolded her story, it became clear that we really had a, at a popular level, limited notion of what Harriet Tubman really had accomplished, even with all we thought she had accomplished. So she was just kind of a, you know, just critical historic figure that touched, you know, so much in her, you know, 90 years of life. And so I wanted to talk about that in the book, but to also frame the proposal to put her on the 20 in the context of the struggles and issues of democracy and race that we're going through now.
If I may, just to depart seemingly from the story which you tell of Harriet Tubman, the issue of education, the issue of education. As I started by saying that this is such a fundamental time, and Women's History Month always is, as was Black History Month, etc., a time to understand and to deal with education. And yet we are up against who gets to tell the narrative, and resting back virtually decades of blood, sweat, and tears from women, from LGBTQIA people, from people of color, from immigrants, who really shaped and gave us more of the division of democracy such as it is in this country, and are still on freedom's paths to realize that. And yet the attack of that narrative in order to raise up American exceptionalism and absolutely blank out, white out the trauma, the settler colonialism that this country was founded on. How important is that to understand in the telling of the story of Harriet Tubman and the work that you do, Dr. Lessing?
So the battle over history is really a battle over the moment, and how we interpret history is really about how we are interpreting where we sit at any particular time. And so the a push to control that narrative, as you point out, isn't just a abstraction. It is very much directly tied to issues of racial justice, women's equality, fairness and inclusion of LGBTQ communities, you know, any issue you can think about, you know, is rooted in the ways in which we think about those issues and how power exploits those moments. And so the accelerated aggression we see right now across the country, from Florida to Texas to everywhere else, to seize control of the education system is directly a result of the victories that happened in the last part of the 20th century, where Black people, Latinos, women, queer community, working people put in place a more genuine understanding of how this country unfolded, whose story should matter. And that's to me where the question of the images on the currency come in. My argument is basically that the images on U.S. currency are intentional narratives that tell political, social, and cultural stories that should be sites of contestation, because the way narrative works and the way symbols work, it's best when they are actually unchallenged, when they kind of fold into the background. So all of us carry around currency with images of Andrew Jackson and Alexander Hamilton and all the rest, and don't necessarily interrogate even how those images ended up on the currency, let alone kind of what the historic meaning is, because the way in which history gets taught. And Andrew, you know, the book is not about Harriet Tubman per se. There's some really, really excellent books on Harriet Tubman, but it's really about Harriet Tubman and her in contrast to Andrew Jackson. And as much as we did not know about Harriet Tubman, I would say the same about Andrew Jackson. And the fact that he gets honored in multiple kinds of ways is an erasure of his role as an enslaver, as a slave trader, as a genocideer, someone who participated personally in massacres of Native people, and someone who pushed through the kinds of public policy that furthered the harm and suffering in those communities. So I thought it was important in the book to get both of those more rigorous kinds of histories out there, but then related to the title, symbolism is directly should be directly connected to and is connected to social change. And so the second part of the book is about the uprisings relative to the killings of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and others, voting rights, the challenge to get rid of these racist public symbols and the issues around COVID-19.
I think the only place I would take issue with you, and we are talking with Dr. Clarence Lussain about $20 and change, and that a book of his, $20 and change, Harriet Tubman and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy, is perhaps one of the deepest books and the most profound about Harriet Tubman, because it does something that is essential. It gives her an intellect. It gives her a vision. It is certainly about the helping of the slaves escape on the Underground Railroad and the enormity of the risk she took. But it's a vision and a visioning of freedom and the essence of democracy, which she continued to live out throughout her entire long life, despite every obstacle, and which we are still trying to realize today. And the book gives us that that bed, that foundation of Harriet Tubman. And how fascinating, how marvelous it is to imbue her with that intellect and that sense of what liberty means, of what equal rights and justice, what it means to establish a beloved community. So in that sense, I thought that the book is one of the deepest and most important reckonings with this woman who we should certainly seek to emulate her visioning still to be carried forward and realized. And I want to probe deeper into that. In your research and in your thoughts and in your efforts to contrast Andrew Jackson, this slaver, this murderer of indigenous people, this advocate of genocide, truly. And there's Harriet Tubman contending right for a space on our national symbol. What was Harriet Tubman's vision as contrasted, and what is a real vision that she gave us of democracy as contrasted to this fraudulent vision that continues to be held up of the Alexander Hamiltons, sorry, Lin-Manuel Miranda, sorry, and people like Andrew Jackson?
So Harriet Tubman, as you pointed out, was a broad visionary. And most of us know her pretty much, as I mentioned, about what she did in helping people escape from slavery. I think less well known is that she played a critical role in the Civil War. She was contracted with the U.S. Military, with the Union Army, and she was a spy. She was a scout. She knew the back fields of Maryland and Virginia, you know, those areas more than anybody else, because she had walked them. And she was a military leader, first woman to lead a military operation. She led about 150 or so black soldiers down the Combahee River in South Carolina, and they attacked Confederate encampments, but they also freed over 700 people who were enslaved, and she brought them back. Not a single person died. Beyond that, though, when the war ended in 1865, she continued to live. She lived to 1913, and that's even less known what her life was like then. But one of the things that I found so rewarding was to read about and to study how she was involved in the suffrage movement and in women's rights. And she was unique in that period because she was in touch with not only white women who were in the feminist movement and the suffrage movement, but many who had broken away from the racial justice movement because they were upset that the 15th Amendment passed in 1870 only included giving men the right to vote, men who had come out of slavery. And so many of them broke with Frederick Douglass and others. But Harriet Tubman was in touch with those folks. But she was also in touch with black women who had formed independent organizations around women's rights and around suffrage. And so, you know, her notion of justice and inclusion didn't stop with the end of the Civil War. It continued all the way literally to her dying moment, when she was deathly ill and on her deathbed in March, early March 1913. This was right before there was a very famous suffrage march that was coming up in Washington, D.C. And the women, the white women who had been organizing that, had initially wanted to exclude black women and then sort of retreated and said black women could march at the back. But they refused. People, women like Ida B. Wells, there were women from Howard University, there were other women in Washington, D.C. who said, we're not going to do that. And, you know, they kind of marched where they wanted. But Harriet Tubman, who was dying and couldn't attend, was being visited by one of the black women leaders. And she sent a message, tell the women to stand together. God would not forsake us. So even as she's dying, she's thinking of how to push for more and more democracy and inclusiveness. Now, she, of course, passed away in 1913, so she never got the right to vote. It did not happen naturally until, the passage of the 19th Amendment in 1920. But this was Harriet Tubman's view of the world. And, you know, she refused to meet with Abraham Lincoln, even though Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth did. Harriet Tubman thought he was insufficiently active in addressing ending slavery. She was very much considering joining John Brown, but there were circumstances, so she wasn't part of the Harper's Ferry uprising that John Brown attempted to do in 1857. But you can see, you know, she was not just limited to I'm going to help people just escape out of slavery and then just sort of sit on my hands. And so I think we have to really honor her for her entire life of really a broad vision of democracy. And then, as you point out, you know, Andrew Jackson, who is given credit by too many historians as someone who he founded the Democratic Party, and he expanded voting rights for white men, but this was self-interest. He had lost the election in 1824, and he figured that the only way he could kind of recover from that would be when he ran again, was to get more people voting for him. But that didn't include women. It didn't include people of color. It was a very narrow view, and all of his policies reflected that.
Dr. Lassane, tell it like it is. And since you mentioned the Combahee River Collective Statement, I noticed as I opened your marvelous $20 and change, Harriet Tubman and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy, that you have a quote. That's the first thing you see in the book. If black women were free, it would mean that everyone else would have to be free, from the Combahee River Collective Statement. Why did you choose that? And for people who may not know the significance of the Combahee River Collective Statement, and we are speaking with Dr. Clarence Lassane, and this is International Women's Day, and that is our focus. Although, as I said, with WBAI, every day must be Women's History Month.
As I mentioned a little bit ago, Harriet Tubman led this raid on down the Combahee River in 1863. In the 1970s, as the women's movement is starting to achieve some victories, and you get a number of organizations like NOW and others They're very white. And many black women did not feel at home. But at the same time, there were also many black women who felt the misogyny and problems of sexism in some of the black organizations were also not welcoming. And so you start to see a number of black women's organizations, and one of the most critical ones was the Combahee River Collective. And this was a group that was started by black queer socialist women who did not, again, feel at home either in the black liberation movement at that point, or let me rephrase that, did not feel some of the black liberation movement organizations and some of the organizations of feminists that were dominated by white women. And they had a radical leftist perspective. So they formed this collective. This was up in Massachusetts, and it included Barbara Smith, who's a black woman writer, her sister. There were others. And they both wrote about why they saw themselves at this particular nexus where other organizations could not meet the needs of radical black queer women, but they also saw themselves as active. And so there were issues going on in the area of black women and other women being killed. And so they, you know, became active around that issue. And so they were, you know, were around for a while, but they issued the Combahee River Collective statement, which was really a radical manifesto asserting where black women, and particularly queer black women, and particularly radical queer black women, really were a point for all of the movements to pay attention to, because they embodied all of these intersections that are critical. And then as Kimberly Crenshaw and others developed these notions of intersectionality, they really give a name to what the Combahee River Collective was really saying and doing.
And let me just tell our listeners, I'm Mimi Rosenberg. You're listening to A Special Equal Rights and Justice for International Women's Day. And our focus today is Harriet Tubman. And I do want to let you know we're going to take a momentary break and return with Dr. Clarence Lussaine with a reading from his book, $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy. But I want to let you know that this book, a must-have now more than ever, because, you see, we have to build our own libraries. We have to propagate our own information because, yep, they're coming for us. I'm sorry. It's not just DeSantos down in Florida. It's not just Abbott in Texas. They are coming for us. They are coming for our history. They are coming to erase, to rebury that which we pulled out, root and branch, the ugliness, the meanness, the cruelty of discrimination, of disparate treatment, of white supremacy. All that to uncover the real narrative of the development of this country and the meanness of plantation capitalism. We made progress with people like Dr. Lussaine, with people like Dr. Gerald Horn, with people like Barbara Smith, and so many others. And what do we have now? Well, we want to make sure that you begin to shore up your own libraries, start your own study groups, educate your own youth, your own work comrades. And so you're going to be able to, if you call 212-209-2950, you can get $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy. And then, an additional special treat. Ah, Courage, Strength, and Legacy. Harriet Tubman, Visions of Freedom, the new film by Stanley Nelson, which is superb. To do what? To educate, agitate, and organize. To empower we, the women. To empower people who have been treated disparately, discriminatorily. And we who follow and choose and must follow in the footsteps of Harriet Tubman, her vision. So you can call 212-209-2950 and you can get the fabulous book, the strategically important book, $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy, and the film, which we will be playing clips galore from in a little while, Harriet Tubman, Visions of Freedom. All you have to do is call and say, and it feels good to say that. Say her name. Raise her name. Lift her name. Harriet Tubman. Harriet Tubman, called 212-209-2950. $125 contribution for a lifetime's education for ourselves. So we're going to take a momentary break and come back with Dr. Clarence Lessaigne with, I hope, a reading from his book on Harriet Tubman.
Mama's crying long,
and she can't get up.
Mama's crying long,
and she can't get up.
Mama's hands are shaking,
and she can't get up.
Mama's hands are shaking,
and she can't get up.
Mama's running hard
from the boss's man.
Mama's running hard
from the boss's man.
Called her anyway,
the boss's man.
Called her anyway,
the boss's man.
They lie on the ground
again and again.
They lie on the ground
again and again.
I can hear her screaming
again and again.
I can hear her screaming
again and again.
Mama's crying long,
she can't get up.
Mama's crying long,
she can't get up.
Mama's hands are shaking,
she can't get up.
Mama's hands are shaking,
she can't get up.
It was late at night
when she got the knife.
It was late at night
when she got the knife.
She went to his room
when she got the knife.
She went to his room
when she got the knife.
Mama's dress is red,
it was white before.
Mama's dress is red,
it was white before.
Lift it up and see,
it was white before.
Lift it up and see,
it was white before.
Mama's crying long,
and she can't get up.
Mama's crying long,
and she can't get up.
Mama's hands are shaking,
and she can't get up.
Mama's hands are shaking,
and she can't get up.
All the men have come,
and they brought the rope.
All the men have come,
and they brought the rope.
They came here for mama,
and they brought the rope.
They came here for mama,
and they brought the rope.
Mama's crying long,
and she can't get up.
Mama's crying long,
and she can't get up.
Mama's hands are shaking,
and she can't get up.
Mama's hands are shaking,
and she can't get up.
Mama's in a tree,
and she can't come down.
Mama's in a tree,
and she won't come down.
Mama's flying free,
and she can't come down.
Mama's flying free,
and she won't come down.
Mama's flying free,
and she can't come down.
Mama's flying free,
and she won't come down.
Mama's flying free,
and she can't come down.
Mama's flying free.
In 1822, an enslaved couple named Ben and Rit welcomed a little girl named Araminta. The new baby was born in Maryland. In the states of the North, slavery was already outlawed, while Maryland and the states to the South relied on enslaved labor.
Maryland was in transition in the 19th century. And more specifically on the eastern shore of Maryland, where enslavers typically had smaller plots of land, smaller numbers of enslaved people working their farms. It really created a different kind of economy, one that required many enslavers to rent out the people they called their property. Harriet Tubman, by the time she's 5-6 years old, she becomes caught up in that web of being hired out.
A childhood experience in slavery is not a childhood. The idea here is that slavery was a profit-driven industry, and slave owners extracted the most profit from all of their enslaved people throughout their lives.
Well, I wonder, will I ever get back home?
Hey. Harriet Tubman's experience of a child was particularly hard. She did things like work in the swamps catching muskrats, where she got very sick and contracted measles and eventually became so ill she had to be sent home.
Well, it must have been the devil who pulled me in. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She was required to clean the house at 6 years old. She didn't know how to clean a house. She also had to babysit a colicky baby who would cry a lot, and every time the baby cried, then the mistress would whip 6-year-old Minty.
Life indoors can be dangerous. You know, this whole business about people in the house having privilege. People in the house are exposed to the slaveholder constantly. When Tubman talks about being with these white women who are enslaving her, it's the wrath and the violence of these women that are visiting upon this child.
But we certainly have myths of white mistresses being the kind slave owner, or, you know, aren't as cruel as their husbands. In truth, oftentimes, women were just as cruel, if not more so. They identified with their husbands, they identified with white supremacy, with white men, and they had the access, which allowed for a greater kind of intimate cruelty on a day-to-day basis.
Young Minty came to prefer working outdoors, where she could breathe just a little freer. She relished any chance to work outside alongside her father, Ben, who was forced to live apart from the family because he was enslaved by different owners.
At the core of slavery is the disunion of the family unit. It was, I'm going to sell your little girl if you don't obey me. Then that's the fear.
Families like Aramintus could be separated, really, at the drop of a dime. Sometimes you were sold away from your family and friends, never to be heard from again. So that concern about sale was something that struck fear, terror, into the hearts of men and women all around the Chesapeake. One of the things happening throughout the early part of the 19th century was the tremendous growth of cotton production, how that completely transformed the lives of enslaved people, how it moved men and women further south to grow what was basically white gold across the southern landscape.
The fear of being sold to the Deep South was real and ever-present for enslaved people in Maryland, like Minty and everyone she knew.
Slave sales were constant every week they were going on. Slave traders from the Deep South would roam the eastern shore of Maryland, for instance, and purchase enslaved people and take them to the Deep South. And enslaved people in Maryland knew that that was a death sentence. The average lifespan for an enslaved person who was purchased in the Chesapeake and brought to Mississippi or Louisiana was about 7 years.
Buying slaves was something that people participated in very enthusiastically. Slave auctions were kind of a social occasion in which a lot of people would come around, sort of look and see what was there. Buying a slave was something that many whites saw as sort of a realization of sort of all their hopes about sort of future wealth, because they thought slaves were an investment.
By 1860, the assessed value of enslaved people was more than $3 billion, more than all industry in the North combined. Prices for enslaved people varied by sex, size, age, and health. Women aged 16 to 24 often commanded the highest prices at markets throughout the South because their bodies had the potential to create more wealth for their owners.
Typically, the slave market was situated within the environment of the courthouse, the green, the public lawn, where the enslaved are bought, sold, and traded.
The reality and the brutality of slavery was front and center. You know, a woman who's hysterical and crying because she's about to be sold away from her children, that's out in the open air for anyone to see.
Menti witnessed the horror firsthand. She watched helplessly as her older sisters, Lina and Soph, were dragged away in chains, screaming, their children ripped from their arms. It was a memory that would haunt her for the rest of her life.
She lived under constant threat, constant terror of being separated forever from her loved ones. When you imagine the psychological impact that this had on a small child, it was a life of terror, of violence, of separation and oppression.
When Menti Ross was about 13, she paid a visit to a store in Bucktown, Maryland, one she had likely entered countless times before. But this visit was different. A chance encounter would change her life forever.
So she was in a general store when an enslaved boy runs in, being chased by his owner or overseer, and she's being asked to hold on to him.
She refuses to do it. The overseer is so furious, he picks up a heavy metal weight and he hurls it in the direction of the enslaved man who's run. But it connects with Araminta's head. It literally fractures her skull.
They carried me to the house all bleeding and fainting. I had no bed, no place to lie on at all. And I stayed there all day and next.
It took her months to recover. She had no medical care. And it left her suffering with seizures her entire life and horrific headaches. And sometimes these seizures would come upon her without notice. She'd be in the field working, and she would just fall to the ground, and she would have tremendous visionary activity. She sometimes felt that she was floating above the earth and looking down at the people watching her lying on the ground.
We don't think about Harriet Tubman as someone who lived with a disability, but she did. She sometimes referred to them as sleeping spells. And it was during these sort of moments of either semi or unconsciousness that she would see things that she understood as signposts from her God.
The visionary side of Harriet Tubman conflated with the intense religiosity of the time and place, so that her visions had a religious dimension and she interpreted them as religious.
As soon as Menti regained her health, her owner Edward Brodus hired her out again. But as she got older, Menti saw a way to use Brodus's greed to her advantage. She offered to pay him a yearly fee for the privilege of hiring herself out to masters of her own choosing. And her world started to open.
She worked in the house and then in their fields, and they were merchants and shipbuilders, and so they sent her to the docks, and she would load and unload things from the ships coming into port. And she became very, very strong. Eventually, she was allowed to work in the forest with her father, who was an expert lumberjack, timber foreman, and ship carpenter. And she became even stronger and more capable.
She wasn't just in one locality, but moving around from place to place. It wouldn't have been shocking to see Harriet Tubman on the roads in Dorchester County. And she knew the landscape because of her travels.
She's a woman who's outside. The watermen that she may be interacting with from the Chesapeake, watermen are very knowledgeable, worldly people. They carry the information because they're on the information highway, which is the waters. So she may have gleaned quite a bit of information from these watermen.
In many ways, the border state of Maryland was unique. There was a large network of over 60,000 free blacks who lived and worked side by side with nearly 90,000 enslaved. In this mix of enslaved and free, the taste of freedom was real and tangible.
One of the distinctive features of being enslaved in Maryland is that you're enslaved in one of the border states, so you're not very far from freedom at any point.
And that possibility kind of changed the way that you could experience your enslavement, that there was a hopefulness, perhaps, that you carried with you.
Around 1844, Minty met a free black man named John Tubman. When they married, Araminta Ross became Harriet Tubman.
When we think about the union between an enslaved woman and a free man, we automatically say, why on earth would a free person, a free man, make the decision to marry an enslaved woman? Why would he do that? Why would he ensure that any children they were to have would be enslaved? And I always sort of answer that question with a one-word answer, which is love.
In the fall of 1849, Harriet's owner, Edward Brodus, died, leaving his widow deeply in debt. Enslaved people knew that the death of a master meant trouble for them. Human property was often used to settle debts. After Harriet watched the widow Brodus sell one group of enslaved people at auction, she decided to leave everyone and everything she knew and loved to run.
She tried to convince her husband John to go along with her, but he was not having any of that. I don't think he was ready to make that trip to the north, understanding that if he was captured, then all the freedom that he did have would be taken instantly.
On September 17th, 1849, leaving her husband John behind, Harriet Tubman stole away into the night with her two brothers, Ben and Henry.
Oh, run, 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 run.
We are the ones. We've been waiting. We are the ones.
We are the ones.
We've been waiting.
We are the ones.
We are the ones.
We've been waiting.
We are the ones.
We are the ones.
We've been waiting.
We are the ones.
We've been waiting.
We are the ones.
A
I'm Mimi Rosenberg, and this is a special Equal Rights and Justice for Women's History Month for International Women's Day. You know, before there was Women's History Month, there was Women's Day, February 28th, 1909, which marked a pivotal moment in history when women stood up for their rights and made their voices heard in the first national Women's Day in New York City. There were a group of Manhattan socialists and suffragettes who organized this event to recognize the first anniversary of the garment strike led by the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, which I used to work for, and my mom was a garment worker. And this meeting was purposely held on a Sunday so people wouldn't miss work. There's so much history, and we'll continue to record this, and Building Bridges is going to do a whole lot more on the issues of the strikes and what happened with marvelous people in March 1910, German activist Clara Zetkin, who proposed that International Women's Day be recognized as an international holiday at the International Conference of Working Women in Copenhagen. And all 17 countries in attendance agreed to the proposal. The film goes so beyond the legend of Tubman to explore what motivated her, what included her inspiration to become one of the greatest freedom fighters in our nation's history. Well, I want to make this film available to you along with the book, which we did in the first part of the program, by Dr. Clarence Lusane. The book, $20 and Change, i.e. the $20 bill, Harriet Tubman's face should be on there, versus Andrew Jackson, $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman and the ongoing fight for racial justice and democracy. And I have just 2 minutes to tell you why you should call 212-209-2950, because one, you're not going to be able to hear the rest of the film, and you also want to see it. And two, you're not going to be able to unless you call in and support the station so that we can continue keep on keeping on. Unless you call 212-209-2950 and ask for Harriet Tubman, you're not going to be able to find out more than Clarence Lusane so beautifully gave to us, but you're not going to be able to find out more about this absolutely praised, essential reading material. It is so engaging. It's so insightful about Harriet Tubman and the influence and imperative that she has and challenge for where we go today. It's challenging. It challenges, really. And what we're doing this morning, is, yes, for International Women's Day, we're bringing you programming that, frankly, we do all the time on WBAI, because as I say and I insist, every day is Women History Month, is Black History Month, is Latinx History Month, is Asia Pacific Island History Month, is Indigenous Peoples History Month, is LGBTQIA History Month, is the History Month of all those people who have been oppressed. It's a history of the working class. And we are here to challenge at its core, the corruption and destruction of the soul that is plantation capitalism, which is the system that exists today that creates the inequities, that thrives off it, and then the control and its policing apparatus to keep people in check. So if you think that's an important message and support this station and want to know more, much more, and be inspired by Harriet Tubman and use her and her life and her legacy and the long tradition she has of resistance to eliminate the ongoing struggle to realize democracy in which her emancipatory vision prevails, then you need a call, 212-209-2950. Support WBAI like you never have before. We need it. It's our megaphone. It's our history recounted, the history of the working class the history of right, to be able to educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of the people, for another world is possible. And when we have the tools being WBAI, and the tools like films like Harriet Tubman, Visions of Freedoms, and books like Harriet Tubman and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy that Clarence Lussain spoke about this morning, then we will make it so. And that is the beloved community that Martin Luther King so righteously advocated and gave his life for. So I'm Mimi Rosenberg. This has been Equal Rights and Justice, a good Women's History Month and International Women's Day. And please call and just ask for Harriet Tubman. Support BAI. Get your gifts. They're fabulous. Get the book. Get the film. Harriet Tubman, Visions of Freedom. And educate, and organize to empower with it. Again, Tubman, $125. Support WBAI, whose station, our station, fragile, frail economically, but we've always supported our own, right? And we're going to continue to do that. 212-209-2950 for Equal Rights and Justice. Mimi Rosenberg here saying, have the best and ongoing Women's History Month. And you'll do that even better when you pledge and support WBAI and get our thank you gifts. Harriet Tubman, Visions of Freedom. Harriet Tubman, the book by Clarence Lussain. And just ask for Harriet Tubman. What beautiful words to be left with. Harriet Tubman. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM. WBAI in New York. This special edition of Equal Rights and Justice with Mimi Rosenberg came to you on recording over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Coming up at 11 o'clock is From the Streets with Bob Law. So please, stay tuned.
The WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting is on Sunday, March 19th at 1 p.m. You are invited to attend. The CAB, or CAB, is an advisory board which reviews programming and other station policies. It represents the diverse views and interests of the communities WBAI serves. If you want to attend the meeting, you can join by teleconference at 619-309-1058. And the PIN number is 641-711. Everyone is invited to call in and join the meeting, and we're happy that more people are now attending CAB meetings. Once again, the call-in number is 619-309-1058, and the PIN number 641-711. We hope that you'll be able to attend. That's the Community Advisory Board meeting, WBAI, March 19th, Sunday, 1 p.m.
WBAI's next town hall, Effective Directing of Resources for Good Influence, will be Sunday, March 26th at 4 p.m. You are paying at your pharmacy's cash register, and the screen to confirm your payment asks you whether you want to round up your payment to make a donation to their charity. Answer, no. Why would you want a pharmacy chain with probably too many connections to big pharma corporations and the medical establishment to be directing your money to where they want it to go? Where do you put your money to influence the world for the better? What about sending some of your money and resources to WBAI and Pacifica for the influence it can have on the world? When resources come into WBAI and Pacifica, how can they best be directed within the Pacifica environment? To improve programming, attracting audiences, or to promote good shows already here? This is what's up for discussion. Give us your thoughts. Zoom in by computer or by Zoom. Go to WBAI's Town Hall webpage for the Zoom link information and phone number sign-in information.
He's exciting.
This dude is bad.
He's sexy.
Okay, maybe not. He's a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
He's Tony Ryan on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. He's got both.
Break him with the sound of the trumpet.
Can you dig it?
Yeah, I can dig it, yeah.
He's got classic soul. He's okay. I can't think of anything else.
I'm Tony Ryan. Tune in Saturday nights, 10 p.m. to 1 a.m.
Soul Central Station with Tony Ryan.
99.5 WBAI.
Extinction Diaries. The Center for Biological Diversity is suing the Biden administration's Fish and Wildlife Agency for what amounts to failing to do its job and act on petitions to protect 9 species under the Endangered Species Act. One of those is a butterfly that only lives in San Diego County in the Baja Peninsula that was desperately petitioned for in 2004 and has been virtually ignored by 4 presidents and thousands of senators and representatives since. The Keno Checker spot was once everywhere in Southern California. Homes and businesses destroyed more than 75% of its habitat. The Checker spot Keno has been listed threatened under the Endangered Species Act since 1997. The insects all butterflies depend on in the region are experiencing their own massive die-offs. The only human response is more insanity as thousands of acres of remaining critical habitat is now slated for development. Construction of the Trump and now Biden border wall is also destroying critical habitat. For nearly 30 years, the cry of extinction has been sounding for the wildlife in this lawsuit. Will humanity someday wake to witness our own cry of extinction? My name is Aaron Oliveira, and this is a Small World Radio production.
I'm Colin Edwards. You are listening to WBAI.